Good morning. Thanks for joining me on the Meg Ellison Show. Hour three, I'm so delighted to have joining me this morning. Barbara Lowe Fisher is the co-founder and president of the charitable National Vaccine Information Center, which was established in 1982 by parents of DPT vaccine-injured children to prevent vaccine injuries and deaths through public education. Barbara is also the co-author of the 1985 book DPT, A Shot in the Dark, and worked with Congress to secure vaccine safety and research provisions in the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986, one of the world's leading non-medical experts on vaccine science, policy, law, and ethics. She has defended freedom of thought. Oh my gosh, do we need her? Speech, conscience, and the ethical principle of informed consent to medical risk-taking for four decades. We were just chatting off air. She's in Florida right now. Well, she lives in Florida now, but I just said, oh, I'm very, well, I hate to say envious, but I do love the state of Florida. Someday maybe, but Barbara is the mother of three children and a grandma. Her oldest son suffered brain inflammation within hours of his fourth DPT shot in 1980 when he was 2.5 years old and was confined to a special education classroom throughout his public school education. Thank you so much for joining me this morning, Barb. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm delighted to be here. I was born in Minnesota.
That's my home state.
Not too far from Wisconsin.
Yes,
oh, really?
Yes, actually. I did not realize that. Where in Minnesota? Yeah.
Minneapolis.
Oh, you, okay, all right. St. Paul for me. I know there's always sort of this battle, but yes, it's not the Minnesota that you and I were born in. Let me just say that, sadly.
No, it's very, everything has changed, hasn't it? And I watched, you know, with my career for 42 years, I've watched this sort of what I call it the vaccine culture war, but it's certainly the vaccine culture war is part of the larger culture wars that are going on around the world and certainly in this country. And, you know, the defending freedom of thought, speech, conscience, informed consent is part of that culture war, unfortunately, that is really moving toward a more authoritarian state that I see, at least in the area that I work in, a merging of corporate, of industries and the government. And in this case, the pharmaceutical industry and government, to the point where you don't really have the kind of oversight on the licensing and regulation, the policymaking of vaccines at the federal level that you really should have. But indeed, that was in place when I came into this work in the early 1980s. There was a little bit of a firewall there between industry and government, but we've seen that torn down in these public-private business partnerships that have grown up in the last, particularly the last 30 years, where you have the pharmaceutical industry, the drug companies producing vaccines in business partnerships with the government. And then when you throw in big philanthropy like the Gates Foundation, the Bloomberg Philanthropies, the Rockefeller Foundation, et cetera, and you throw that into the mix with so much money that is being given to the major universities in this country by both government, industry, and the big philanthropy, all really wanting to shut down the public conversation about vaccination that challenges either what the federal government says about vaccines or the World Health Organization says about vaccines. It's very distressing because I consider it an assault on freedom of thought, speech, and conscience, and the natural right to autonomy and protection of bodily integrity, which I think, you know, the right to autonomy is the first human right, and it is under assault. And for political reasons, for economic reasons, industries that do not want to have an open conversation, particularly online, about vaccine risks and about vaccine effectiveness and about whether we should be using 72 doses of 17 vaccines to give to our children between day of birth and age 18, whether that's a good thing and is it resulting in better health for our children, or whether maybe we've overdone it and we need to really take another look and alter these public health policies so that we can protect the health of our children and not make it worse.
Well, you know, when you say overdone it, I would imagine the big pharma execs would have cause to disagree with you, because I'm convinced with each day that passes, particularly after observing what happened during what I like to call the shamdemic, and then the results of that, the poison COVID shot, I'm inclined to believe that the less the public knows, the happier big pharma is, and mm-hmm. As you're describing, all these other entities that are in cahoots. I mean, that's the word that I guess I'll use to describe it. They're in cahoots with big pharma, because I mean, I think about how the left heralds someone like Anthony Fraud Fauci as some sort of hero, and his record, it speaks for itself. But I mean, I can't even imagine being in your shoes and observing what you accomplished over your the lifetime of your career, and then observing what happened over the last couple of years with regard to this additional, and I don't even like to call it it's not a vaccine, but this additional shot that they're now pushing and perhaps want to add to the list of childhood vaccines.
I completely agree with everything you said. It has been shocking for me in the last couple of years. I mean, I predicted back in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, that the day would come when we would not be able to hold a job or get into a public space or ride on a plane or a train. We wouldn't be able to travel, et cetera, unless we had all the government-recommended vaccines. But because I knew I was sitting at the table with the, quote, vaccine stakeholders, industry, government, medical trade, and I was their consumer representative for more than two decades on vaccine advisory committees, both at the federal level and at the Institute of Medicine, National Academy of Sciences. And I made multiple presentations back in the 80s and 90s, and I debated multiple doctors on television. I've debated more doctors on television than any other American on this subject. But I was shut off in 2015. I never was invited again to go on TV to debate a doctor. That's when the screws really started to be put on this whole issue of freedom of speech with regard to vaccination. But in the last, what happened during the pandemic, the isolation, the lockdown, I had not anticipated. That threw everybody into a state of shock when that happened in the winter spring of 2020. And they had been planning for a long time to, quote, prepare for a pandemic. And in fact, when I sat on the National Vaccine Advisory Committee in 1988, that was one of the first subcommittees that they formed, was the Pandemic Influenza Subcommittee. And so for a long, long time, they've been looking for this time when everybody would have to, I guess, be locked down like what they did, which, of course, ruined our economy and other economies around the world. And we paid a great price of mental health, setting back our children's educational development. It was just such a shock. And everybody was so afraid. They made everyone so afraid of this virus. Now, this was a bioweapon virus. I truly believe it was created in a lab, in a biohazard lab in China with U.S. funding. That's become clear from what the documents that are now coming forth in a congressional investigation. It did. I had COVID three times, and it was very severe, and I was left with AFib. It really did do a number on some people who were vulnerable to it. But it wasn't the mortality rate with it is not what they originally had hyped. And everyone was so afraid. And 80% of the people in this country got at least one COVID shot. That's a phenomenal uptake of a vaccine. And you're right, it's not a vaccine. It's a shot. I call it a cell disruptor biological. Mm-hmm. It disrupts the function of the cell, of your cells, and basically turns your body into what the World Economic Forum calls a vaccine manufacturing plant. So it was a stunning event, but the one thing that's happened from it is that public awareness had been rising over 40 years. I mean, certainly the work that we did, especially in the states where we were fighting to save exemptions, vaccine exemptions, where we were fighting against more vaccine mandates, we were fighting against vaccine tracking systems that identify and track you. This pandemic has awakened people all over the world to the issue of vaccine risks and the fact that this particular product, labeled as a vaccine, did not prevent infection and transmission. So all of the hype that, you know, you were going to die, and anybody you came in contact with, if you had it, was going to die, unless you got vaccinated, was a complete deception. It doesn't prevent infection and transmission. And yet it comes with a lot of risk. More than 1.5 million adverse events associated with the COVID vaccine have been filed with the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS, which is a safety provision that we got into that 1986 Act. And that is more than any other. It's like the leading adverse vaccine that causes reactions that is filed in VAERS, more than any other. And so, you know, all this denial that these people who are talking about what happened to them. And the difference was, this time they targeted adults, teenagers and adults, before all the vaccines had been added to the schedule to targeted babies and children who cannot talk. And, you know, it's very difficult if an infant has seizures or stops developing normally, et cetera. It's very difficult because they can't talk about how they feel after a vaccine reaction. But these adults who have gotten this COVID vaccines, they can talk, and they do know what they were before, what they were after. I was lucky. My son was 2.5. I knew what he was like before and what he was like after. I walked in on his vaccine reaction. Most parents don't walk in on a child's vaccine reaction, and they don't realize and don't make the connection between what the vaccinations that their child got and subsequent deterioration in health that can be from learning disabilities like what my son suffered, to autism, to mental retardation, to medication-resistant seizure disorders, to death. So I urge everybody, before you take a risk with a vaccine, you need to do your research. You need to find out the complications of the disease that they're telling you should, you know, use the vaccine to prevent, and then also the complications of the vaccine, and be an informed make an informed decision.
You know, I don't know what it is, if it was just general distrust of our government, or if there's something to be said, Barb, for women's intuition. But I was, right from the very start, I was skeptical about this poison shot. But I never, until the poison COVID shot, I never considered myself to be anti-vax. I am all out 100% anti-vax at this point. I'll take my chances on stepping on a rusty nail. I wouldn't even take a tetanus shot anymore, because I just do not trust those who are in the, and it's a sad thing to say out loud. It's a sad thing to realize, is that I just don't trust those in our medical community that they're looking out for what's best for me as an individual. I think it's all so profit-driven that they could care less about the potential side effects and the obvious side effects from a lot of these vaccines, the childhood vaccines, as well as this poison COVID shot.
Well, you know, I understand how you feel. You know, while we're all born equal under the law, we're not all born the same. We come to the process of vaccination, or indeed to the doctor's office, with different genetics, different epigenetics, different microbiomes. We come from different environments where we're exposed to environmental toxins. We're not all the same. We don't all respond the same way to medical interventions like vaccines. And so really these mandatory vaccination policies are a de facto selection of the vaccine vulnerable for sacrifice. They could have done the science. I, for for 40 years, I have begged them to do the science to find out who is more at risk, who is biologically, genetically at risk for having adverse responses to vaccination. They have refused to do the science. So what are they doing? They're adopting a utilitarian for the greater good pseudoethic, which was discredited at the doctor's trial at Nuremberg, you know, when they issued the Nuremberg Code and said when you test people, when you have scientific experiments on humans, you cannot, you have to allow them to exercise informed consent. You have to tell them what the risks are to their life, and you have to allow them to make a voluntary decision without being coerced or sanctioned for the decision they make. And that's why I adopted the informed consent ethic, and I applied it to vaccination. I did that in the in 1997 publicly on a debate I did on the Today Show, that you cannot separate out vaccination from the informed consent principle. But you know, it's shocking that they haven't done the science, that they continue to wrap themselves around this idea that some can be sacrificed for the rest.
Ugh.
That it's, you know, your duty to take the risk, even if you're at high risk. It's your duty to take the risk for everybody else. Well, that's not an equal application of vaccine risk in society. And that is immoral to just throw people under the bus. You haven't even found out how many people you're throwing under the bus. And to prop up a policy and products that have no liability. Nobody who was involved in the vaccine process, from the development, research and development of vaccines, to the making of vaccines and the marketing of vaccines and profit making from vaccines, to the licensing or the policy making or the mandating of vaccines, has any accountability in a court of law. Now, why would we ever, as a people, give up our right to hold those who are making and profiting from vaccines and who are licensing and recommending and mandating vaccines? And we get hurt and we cannot have justice anywhere? No. And that's why I said in 2011, when the U.S. Supreme Court took away all remaining liability from the vaccine companies in Brusewitz versus Wyeth, 2011, it was a DPT vaccine injury case. And all the companies, all the drug industry lined up with their amicus brief, and all of medical trade, and all of public health, and all the federal agencies, and they sided with Wyeth. They sided with the company. Here's MVIC with our amicus brief and these organizations representing damaged children. And we basically, you know, everybody said, sorry, you don't get to hold anybody accountable. No more liability for the drug industry on vaccines. The same day that they voted to not hold the companies liable for product design defect, failure to make a safer vaccine, they held the car manufacturers liable for failure to make safe seatbelt safe, for failure to you know, defective seatbelt design was okay to sue a car company, but you couldn't sue a drug company for defective vaccine design. So, I mean, it's, I say buyer beware.
Right.
The compensation system that we created in the 1986 Act has been totally gutted by the Congress and congressional amendments and by Department of Health and Human Services in rulemaking authority. They did that after the law was passed. They went about gutting it. They gave the doctors medical malpractice liability protection. That wasn't in the law when it was passed. And as I said, design defect was still there for the companies, but the Supreme Court took it away in 2011, and they weakened the safety provisions. So, you know, I have reasons why, objective reasons why I don't trust. And I can see many people like you who now don't trust because of what they did with COVID. I always knew they would overstep.
Right. They always
do. Yeah. I knew that they would overstep because their hubris is so great.
Right. Yeah. I guess I will say this. I just have so little confidence, and I mean, again, it makes me sad to say this, and I don't think that this is reflective of every single person in the medical field. Of course not. I think there are a lot of very decent, principled people that went into medicine or the medical field, healthcare for the right reasons, but they're caught up in what is now, again, I just think the big pharma is driving how medicine is practiced in, or again, of course, medicine, I'm using the term, but how the healthcare field is operated now. And I mean, I've completely changed my attitude even about receiving any kind of health care from a what I would consider a traditional doctor any longer, because I just have no trust, and I do not believe that they, in good conscience, I mean, isn't there that little old thing called the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm? And I mean, I just, Barb, I don't understand how these doctors, I mean, I get it, I suppose they're protecting their livelihoods and their paychecks and, you know, whatever, their futures. But I mean, you must be heartened by the fact that there are high profile physicians that are speaking out. Our Senator, United States Senator Ron Johnson, been very outspoken about all of this. But then Dr. Pierre Corey, Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. Paul Merrick, I don't know about Dr. Robert Malone. I've just been kind of reading conflicting things about it. But I would imagine you're heartened by it, because finally there are physicians that were part of the system that can no longer in good conscience practice the same way because of what they have learned, the system has revealed about themselves.
Well, you know, Meg, all along there were doctors. There were brave doctors, and we would have them. We hosted four international public conferences on vaccination over the years since 1997, and the fifth one in 2020 was in October of 2020 during this pandemic. We had to hold it online because we couldn't hold it in a hotel because of these restrictions. But in those conferences that started in 1997, we would gather physicians who were dissidents, who were speaking, who would stand up at our conference and say, you know, this vaccine or that vaccine, talk about the science, talk about how the vaccine hadn't been appropriately tested, et cetera. But they were in, of course, a very small minority. And in fact, many of them risked their careers, and many of them had their careers destroyed because they stood up at our conferences and said their truth. But the thing that happened during the pandemic was everything, the whole world was looking at this disease and vaccine and these lockdown policies, and these doctors who, you know, when they step forward in the second decade or third decade of the 21st century, it was covered. And of course they have been hammered, you know, many of them thrown out of hospitals, thrown out of their colleges that they were at. They have paid a price, just like the others did as well, but it's been more high profile because of the pandemic. So I am encouraged. I'm encouraged by the congressional investigations in Congress. I just finished a major report that I published. I stopped everything in August. I took 3 months, and I did a deep dive into the medical literature and into the mainstream media and looked at, I wanted to find out, why was NVIC, after all the work we tried to do inside of government, sitting on these government advisory committees, participating in public engagement projects at the federal level, and also the work we've done with state legislatures at the state level, which is what you're supposed to do in our constitutional republic. You're supposed to participate in a civil way if you want to change something. Why were we the first to be thrown off of social media in March of 2021? And what, between March of 2021 and September of 2021, NVIC was taken off of all four social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And my 15 years of commentaries on YouTube, gone. And then in December December 23rd of 2021, at night, we were called by Network for Good, which we had processed our donations for more than a decade. And the entity they used to process it financially, it was PayPal. And we were told that night, in the middle of our end-of-year fundraising campaign, that no donations would be processed, that it was cut off. So anybody trying to make a donation couldn't make a donation to our charity. And we're a very highly rated charity, a 501c3 charity, in good standing. So I didn't understand what had happened. And I was so busy trying to put out information and keep things together during this pandemic, and we had been thrown off of social media. I just didn't stop until in August this year. And I went and I looked and I found out what happened. And what I found out shocked me. Even though I had been doing all this, I knew who our adversaries were. I had no idea the depth and the extent to which the U.S. government was involved. I did not understand that the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense and the Department of Justice, Department of State, Department of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, I knew Department of Health and Human Services, U.S. Surgeon General, United Nations. We were targeted by federal agencies, as well as foreign political operatives like Imran Ahmed of the Center for Countering Digital Hate in the United Kingdom that worked with government, and then these big philanthropy and think tanks and philanthropic foundations, the Gates Foundation, Rockefeller, Bloomberg, and World Economic Forum, Aspen Institute, then the big pharma-associated institutes like Sabin Vaccine Institute, Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, for-profit media companies like NewsGuard that rate websites they put nutritional value ratings, you know, were way low, you know. But they engaged in this huge national and international effort to target people like me and MVIC for elimination from the digital public square so that nobody could hear us, nobody could see us. And Google, you know, the algorithms that are used to suppress access to information was applied to us. And I was outraged. I mean, we're supposed to, in this constitutional republic, if we want to change something, we're supposed to work within the system. That's what we did. And they didn't like it. And so they decided they're going to eliminate us.
Barbara Lowe Fisher, thank you for joining me. I got to let you go. But, you know, we started out this conversation by saying that Minnesota, our birth state, isn't what it used to be. And I would say that, sadly, I would say that about the same about our very own country, the United States of America, just what we've talked about and what you went through, what you have endured as a result of government censorship. I do hope, and I think I take a solace in the fact that because there are so many more people that are outspoken and wide awake about this, that we're going to have to continue to push back, and there's strength in numbers, and we need to keep speaking out, and you need to continue to be a guest on different programs like mine, and you're always welcome back. We'd love to have you back to discuss this some more.
Thank you. Everybody can go to nvic.org. That's our website. And you can join our NVIC advocacy portal and work in your state to protect your right to make vaccine choices.
nvic.org. I'm going to go out there right now as well. Well, again, thank you. Barbara Lowe Fisher, thanks for joining me this morning. I appreciate it so very much. I hope you have a great day. We'll talk soon.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Rolling a little bit late into the 10:30 news, followed by, as I promised, your calls on the other side, 715-845-2155 on the Mega Ellefson Show on WSAU.